Friday postgame show solo. I know from reading the comments that some people get excited when Dave Kohler does a Friday postgame show solo. This is not one of those weeks to be excited, I don't think. You know, Cenk starts off every show saying you're going to have an awesome show, but about once or twice a year, he's honest and says, I don't think this one's going to be awesome. This is my once or twice a year moment. I really not quite sure we're gonna have it, but I'm going to try. You know, I think there are three things I like to do if I could dedicate myself, which I can't right now, to the Friday postgame show or any postgame show. One is comment about everyone on news that I think is important that the TYT main show doesn't cover. Two would be inside baseball. And I don't even remember what the third thing that I like to do is. But inside baseball is becoming more and more impossible because the company is getting bigger. There's different people involved. There's different levels of management and control. There's PR. There's legal issues. I don't know what inside baseball to say and what not to say anymore. So there's less and less inside. There's plenty of stuff to say, but I don't feel as free to talk about inside baseball anymore. So that leg of my three-legged chair is out. I don't even remember what one of the legs is. So all I'm left was looking through the internet for stories that I think are important, but that the main show didn't cover. It's really hard, and I don't dedicate all my time to this. I got a lot of other things to do. But no one needs to hear the wah. What is this, wah hour? Wah. Let me get into the stories. Yeah, thanks. We'll be hearing more from Bart, believe me, in the second half of this show. So, Irma, we are going to start with the family tree. I hope I didn't quick pitch you on that one. So, a computer scientist from Columbia University studied genealogical information online and developed a coherent, legitimate, valid family tree of 13 million people, which is the size of like Belgium or Cuba almost. And there it is in graphical form, completely unintelligible to us. I think the green is people and the red lines are connections. But we all know what a family tree is. You got your four grandparents and they had their children and then it's down to you. And most people see three or four generations in a family tree. If you look in some history book of the British royalty, you get a few more. But this guy did a complete family tree of 13 million people. They're all related. And yeah, actually, Kevin Bacon is not even a joke. He is in that 13 million. So that's pretty funny. And a couple of little nuggets came out of it when he did it. In 1750, generally people married someone who lived within 6 miles of them. In 1950, that has expanded to 60 miles. I think 60 miles, and I wonder what it is today. Why do I care about what it was in 1950? But those two numbers make sense, and it's kind of cool. But we all know that transportation is a lot more readily available and cheaper, and the world is going national and global, and so you meet people from farther from where you live. In 1850, it was very typical for a person to marry his or her fourth cousin because family trees are so big and complex, and you don't even sometimes know that someone might be your fourth cousin back in 1850. Today, when they did the analysis, it's not uncommon for people to marry their seventh cousin. That's about the average. That still kind of creeps me out a little bit. And I think what seventh cousin means is so you have your cousins, their children are your second cousins, their children are your third, fourth. I think that's what it means. So by the time you get to seventh cousin, of course, you don't even know who they are. But when you do a genealogical analysis like this computer scientist did, you realize that people are marrying their seventh cousins. I did not marry my seventh cousin. I don't think anyone else who's listening to me right now, other than the 19 people out there, are even married. So I can't take a poll of TYT here to see if anyone married their seventh cousin or not. Let's stay on the issue of human kind of health and scientific research. This was an interesting little nugget. It's not going to take long. Some scientists studied sickle cell anemia That is the disease. It's a genetic disease in which I believe some blood cell, you know, a particular gene, a mutation, and your blood cells have trouble carrying oxygen. It's related to natural protections that humans in Africa had against malaria. But it's a disease that kills 100,000 people a year, and 5 million people have it. It's a bad thing, but they've did the DNA analysis of this disease and traced it to the origins of sickle cell anemia to one baby, one particular baby who got the mutation in West Africa 7,300 years ago. Of course, we don't know who that baby is, but it's kind of cool to think that scientists were able to narrow down the origin of this entire disease that now afflicts the whole world, although it's not the worst disease in the world. And they know the exact origin of it from 7,300 years ago, a single mutation in a single baby, and now we're all living with it. That baby, what an impact. He had no idea what impact on human history he would have, but that baby is the source of sickle cell anemia. I am scared at how quickly I'm going through these topics. Global warming, Young Turks talk about it all the time, what the problems are. I try to bring it up. I read about a new one, so I wanted to share with you with it. Some scientists, agricultural specialists, did some research into legumes. Legumes are the plants and the food sources that are like beans and lentils and peas and that kind of thing. And it turns out that under conditions of higher CO2 and higher temperatures, legumes, which are an important part of the human diet, they will grow with less protein content in them. So of all the other problems that global warming is going to inflict upon society, another one is that our legumes will have fewer proteins. So it's going to cause a deficiency in nourishment among human beings because of global warming. It's just one more in a list of hundreds of negative impacts of increased CO2 in the atmosphere from human activities. All right, let's talk a little bit about everyone's favorite thing when I can do it, which is I do have, no, I don't want to rush this one into 2 minutes, or maybe I will. All right, so I do have one little comment about Cenk and the Young Turks. We're all excited here at the Young Turks, legitimately, about the candidate for Congress in Kansas, who's a TYT member, Brent Welder. He's doing great in his race for Congress. But I just want to point out, Cenk presents it as, here we are in Kansas, a deep red state, and we got this progressive TYT member leading in his race for a House seat. And that is great. But to say that it's in deep red Kansas is misleading, because you don't run for Congress in Kansas. You run in a particular district. The district he happens to be running in is urban and suburban Kansas City. It's not what you would think of as Kansas. And in fact, that district voted slightly in favor of Hillary Clinton in 2016. So it's not that crazy that this progressive candidate is leading the race. Still, I think it's awesome that a progressive at all is leading in a race in the polls for Congress, that he's a TYT fan and member. So I love it and I support it. I just, when Cenk says, you know, a TYT member and progressive is leading in deep red Kansas, that's the type of slight mischaracterization that I like to point out, just because I can be a jerk like that. I want to talk about one of Cenk's, a great thing Cenk did, but we're going to have to do that after I catch my thoughts and have a drink of water here. I forgot to riff for a little bit on a couple of things. First, I love all the suggestions for country music artists for me to listen to. 2 weeks ago when I did my solo show, I talked about how I've discovered late in life country music and how I want to get into it and listen to a lot. And the comments below that video on our website, many people were excited. I'm glad to see how many TYT hidden country music fans are coming out of the woodwork. And they wrote all long lists of people who I should listen to and artists. And I'm going to start doing that. The only one I've listened to so far is this guy named Junior Brown. And I like it. It's not exactly country. It's a medley of styles. Bart, do you know anything about this guy?
I vaguely know about Junior Brown.
It's a no.
Just a little bit.
All right. Well,
just a little bit, you know. Yeah. It's like I know enough music to get by. You know, it's like my country music is a little bit in my weak area of my music DNA. There's things that are country music like that I like, but not
crossover.
Well, yeah, like I mentioned last time, like for me, country music, I'd stop listening around the mid '80s when I turned into arena rock, and that's when I tuned out.
Anyway, I appreciate those suggestions, and I'm going to go artist by artist, but I'm not going to rush. I have all the time in the world to listen to it because now I don't. You know, there's no need to rush. I waited this long. I can wait 7 more years to learn all that stuff. I'm going to listen to early Loretta Lynn and I forget some of the other names there. All right, the other thing that I love about the Friday postgame show when Malcolm does it is the background stuff that he does. I didn't pick one this week, but these guys, I don't know if it was Edwin or Irma who did it, but I love this. This is, I've been told, La Paz. I thought it was Canada. It could be, you know, it's night. There's mountains and there's a city. Could be the Rockies, could be Alberta. But it's La Paz, Bolivia. Anything to do with Bolivia I always warms my heart. I don't have a story about it or anything. I did look for Bolivia stories to cover today, and there weren't really any that I found. I know that I mentioned 2 weeks ago that during Carnival in the city of Oruro, there were 2 explosions and they were trying to investigate the cause. I haven't seen an update on those. It's probably the gas tanks from the street cookers. But then some authorities thought it was dynamite and maybe deliberately set. So, but I didn't get any updates on that. But it's a shout out to La Paz and thank you whoever came up with putting that there. It warms my heart and makes me dream of other places that I could be instead of under the lights here. All right, so on to what Cenk did very well. This is no secret because Young Turks is publicizing as much as possible. He predicted that Rex Tillerson was going to be out after that Exxon Russian oil deal fell apart. And that was a great prediction. I got to give him credit for that. It was, I think, 5 days before before Rex Tillerson departed or was fired. And I mean, Cenk nailed it. Rex Tillerson's entire purpose at the State Department was to make sure that deal went through. Once Exxon decided not to do it, there was no need for him. But it's amazing how that theory or fact/theory doesn't make the mainstream press articles at all. They're completely oblivious to that connection. But that's why TYT is, or when those are the cases where TYT is superior to mainstream media. And that was great, great work, a good prediction. 5 days is not like the next day, but that's definitely well within the acceptable range of giving Cenk full credit for that prediction. And he is not shy of taking it. TYT is publicizing the crap out of that. I've gotten like 5 emails already through the TYT, you know, public emails about promoting that clip. So that's that. All right, so the big mystery of this postgame show is if I'm going to do any obits and if I'm going to do Stephen Hawking. Because listen, my obituaries are not supposed to be about the famous people. They're supposed to be about sub-famous people. Everyone knows who Stephen Hawking is. He should have been covered on the main show, but I checked YouTube and I didn't see a video. I don't know if they covered Stephen Hawking and didn't put it on YouTube. Bart, do you know if they talked about Stephen Hawking on the main show?
No, not on the main show. The main show pretty much glossed over the passing of Stephen Hawking, which I was like, he's a super genius.
That's
they
should cool.
mention him. Yeah, it's not cool.
Yeah, so, all right, I will talk about it. So, Irma, roll some graphic here. It's worth it just for that alone, even if I had nothing to say about it. And I'm not giving it, I don't have a picture of Stephen Hawking because everyone knows what he looks like. We don't have to stare at him anymore. Everyone knows. That's not the point of this. What I want to talk about, and I'm not going to go through his life. You can read his obituary. He's an important person, 20th century science. Educate yourself about him. That's fine. But his big, big breakthrough having to do with merging theories of gravity and quantum physics and relating them to black holes. His big breakthrough in that theoretical area of physics was based on him having a position that was wrong, actually. So he was in a debate. I got all this from the obituary in the New York Times. So if some of it's a mischaracterization, don't blame me. Correct it in the comments, and I'm sure someone will. He got into a debate with a physics graduate student at that time, late 60s or early 70s, about whether anything can emerge, be emitted from a black hole. Conventional wisdom was it cannot. That's why it's called a black hole, because nothing comes out, no light, you can't see it. And Stephen Hawking was thinking along those lines. But this other graduate student in physics at Princeton thought something, you know, that radiation could be emitted from a black hole. Stephen Hawking didn't think so. But to Stephen Hawking's immense credit, he went back to his brain, because that's all he could do, and thought it out and did the theories and did the calculations. And to see, all right, he didn't just take his position on faith. He worked it out scientifically and mathematically. And it turns out Stephen Hawking's notion or instinct was wrong. The other guy was right. When he did the math, Stephen Hawking discovered that some radiation could be emitted, from a black hole, could be detected coming out of a black hole. And in the process that he merged, you know, to some degree, theories of gravitation and quantum physics. And that was his big scientific breakthrough that launched his fame. And it was all based on a notion that he had that was wrong. So I think that's kind of cool. And that's the only reason the Stephen Hawking obit made it into the show, other than the cool graphic, because that's a little something interesting about him. Otherwise, he's too big a name for me to cover.
Well, there's three things I want to mention about Stephen Hawking. Actually, two recommendations and one thing. The first thing I recommend anybody to go out and see the documentary on Stephen Hawking that came out in 1991 called A Brief History in Time. If anybody just wants to get the basic schematics of what Stephen Hawking is all about, Brief History in Time, highly recommend it. Number two, if you ever get a chance, watch Stephen Hawking's appearance on The Simpsons. Funny, very funny. And third is more or less a question, and I asked this question to you before we started the Friday Post game. I'm going to pretty much ask this question to our members. Who would win in a street fight, Stephen Hawking or Carl Sagan? That's my question. And who do you think would win, Dave?
I'm not going to... It's a preposterous part.
No, it's not preposterous. Stephen Hawking would win.
If anyone cares,
Stephen Hawking would
win. They'll be able to answer in the comments, but I don't have any.
Well, here's the reason why I think Stephen Hawking should win. Because they told him he was going to die like 50 years ago, and he didn't. And he made it to win. He made it this long in life. So I think Stephen Hawking would kick Carl Sagan's ass.
Well, Stephen Hawking had an indomitable spirit. Yeah, it kept him alive and it kept him active. And at the top of his field, that's for sure. But his tools are limited, to say the least, or were. Now they're both of them are have no tools left at all. And Stephen Hawking, I really, really was not interested in these ideas of afterlife and God and all that. You know, I don't know the details about his religiosity, but he has gone to, you know, he's just going to decay into molecular substance, and that's fitting for Stephen Hawking. All right, so I have one more story left, then I'll catch my breath, and then we're going to be in a little bit of trouble. So the story left is a California story, Shasta Dam Project. I thought Republicans were all about states' rights. Of course they're not. They're full of shit. They're about states' rights when it suits them. They're not about states' rights when it doesn't suit them. There's a million examples of it. Example number 1,000,001 is coming up in a couple seconds on this postgame show. I'm going to say something about Evo Morales that just occurred to me since we're looking at La Paz in the background. You know, there's a lot of good political analysis, and then there's a lot of people who are filling time. I'm trying to be honest with you. I'm having trouble filling this time. But here's the article I read that just kind of, it was well written, and I learned something from it. But what's the point? Like, is it deep political analysis? No. So the article is about why has Evo Morales in Bolivia lasted so much longer than some of the other leftist leaders in South America. And here's the brilliant conclusion that only a mind like Stephen Hawking could have come up with. One, The opposition was not united against him. And two, his supporters were very united. No friggin' duh. That's why. That's not that deep of an analysis. But now I simplified a little bit. The part about Evo Morales' supporters being united behind him is important, actually. In Bolivia, there's lots of sectors to society, but they're all, many of them were excluded from the political discourse. They were marginalized. They were not counted in the political system. Evo Morales, before becoming president as a union leader, began a movement to unite them. And as president, he's kept them united. And his movement, which he calls the Movement Towards Socialism, it really is a movement, and it's lasted for over a decade or however long, 20 years or however long. He's actually been able to maintain it. There are leftist movements like in Ecuador, and Ecuador elected a very progressive left-leaning president, but that movement split. The president wasn't able to maintain it. There was a feud within the two leaders, and they split off from each other, and now that movement is fractured. Same thing happens in Chile and in Argentina. Now, the other reason Evo Morales has been able to last so long is not just that his movement is united, his opposition is not united. He's also had good policies which have improved the lives of millions of Bolivians. And that's the most important part. And I always talk about it because I am looking at Bolivia as, not only because I like the country and spent a lot of time there, but it's a shining example of how maybe things can be done right in these impoverished third world countries. You don't need a right wing dictator to impose law and order. Maybe you can do progress from the left. And I'm not overlooking that just we're going to eventually, and already have heard plenty of stories of corruption and favoritism, but they're not that many stories about that. Not like you get out of Mexico or Argentina or bigger countries like that where there's more at stake. The history book is not written on Evo Morales, but man, it's pretty good right now. It's pretty good right now. And I get it that I might be oversimplifying it, but we always are. If you don't live in a country and you're not immersed there, you don't really know what's going on. So I teased this latest states' right hypocrisy from the Republicans. So there's a dam in Northern California, the Shasta Dam. There's a lot of dams in California and all over the West. That's how we have our water supply. And there's some people who have argued for years now to raise Shasta Dam, create a bigger reservoir to have more water stored for agricultural use and human use and society and drinking and industrial use and all that. But making a dam bigger has an environmental impact. The reservoir, the lake behind it gets bigger, wipes out more terrain, more habitat. And so in the case of the Shasta Dam, it's been debated thoroughly in California, and it's a violation of California law, and it's a negative impact to the environment to raise the level of the Shasta Dam to create a bigger reservoir. So it's been rejected by state authorities. But there's a water district that is heavily invested in agricultural in the Central Valley, and they have a direct tie-in to the Trump White House. In fact, the number two guy at the Department of the Interior, I think, comes from this California Water District. And so business interests are in favor of raising the Shasta Dam and having more water for the agricultural interests. And so the federal government, the Trump administration, is saying to hell with California's rejection of the increase, and they want to do it anyway. They want to increase the size of Shasta Dam. They don't care about states' rights. When it's in their interests, the Republicans who lead the government just want to do whatever the hell they want for their corporate interests, for their donors, for their personal pockets. So it's just, that's like I said, it's example million and one in which states' rights is just lip service. When they want to oppress black people, then you have to honor states' rights. But when you have to make money off agricultural interests, then you F states' rights and you just do whatever you want. And that Shasta Dam conflict comes along with all the other conflicts between the Trump administration and California regarding immigration, of course. California wants to set its course on what it does with sanctuary cities, and the federal government says nothing doing. We're going to impose and sue California to do what we want to do. No states' rights there either. Malcolm, Steve, I need you. I miss you. Please come back. Where are you guys? And no, we'll be all right, though. So to celebrate TYT's true authenticity and identity, Bart and I are going to get nostalgic. So back in, I think, 2006, we were all outraged at all the atrocities committed by the Bush administration. And one of them was when the special prosecutor either indicted or convicted Scooter Libby, who was Dick Cheney's aide, for very serious obstruction of justice charges. And George W. Bush pardoned him or commuted his sentence or whatever the technicality was. And Jenks said, that's enough. Enough is enough. And he started a protest Sunday mornings in front of the federal building here in LA on Wilshire Boulevard near Veteran. And Cenk was brilliant because at the time he was living in an apartment about two blocks away. So all he had to do was roll out of bed, go to the protest, hang out with a couple of TYT friends for a few hours, and then go home and watch football. Because we set him early Sunday morning, not too hot, not to interfere too much with football. And this thing actually took off. After a couple weeks, a lot of people showed up with banners. And eventually we got General Wesley Clark to show up. Of course, we knew his son at the time who brought him in. And then this spread. There was a big one in a San Diego suburb. I saw pictures of it at the time. They had a lot of people, more than we had, every Sunday protesting, just saying enough, enough. And I thought that was great. It was fun to meet the fans. It was like a meetup and a protest at the same time. And I don't know if that's exactly where we met you, Bart, but you were just coming on board around that time.
Well, yeah, I have to briefly going back to, I think that's the ideal set for doing a protest. For me, if I was doing a protest, yeah, I want it close to where I live and I don't have to walk very far, and then I can go home and just watch whatever's on TV Sunday. Because for me, like, protesting, it's hard work.
Yeah, it is.
And I do enough hard work as it is. And I remember those enough protests, and I gotta say, and I'll spread a little bit of braggadocious on it. The enough protests, it was the precursor for the Occupy protest. Before there was Occupy, there was TYT Enough protest, and I remember those protests. And I have some of those pictures. And I remember seeing General Wes Clark.
Yeah.
But I didn't know who he was at the time because it looked like he was just some guy just sitting on.
Well, he ran somewhere. For it looked president like he, in 2004.
Yeah, I didn't recognize
before.
Him, and it looked like he just went to the golf course and played around a golf and decided to hang out in front of the federal building, and then later on someone mentioned who he was. I was like, oh, okay, that's pretty cool. But like that enough protests actually. My history with TYT goes a little bit before the enough protests. It was actually a Sunday morning in March of 2005. I was at home reading my Sunday paper and on the calendar section. It was that
story. We got a spread in the Sunday LA Times.
Yeah, it was that. And I read that paper, I read that story, and then I started watching the show. It was like right around the time when TYT was starting to do videos. And my first impression of the show was on Cenk Uygur. It was like, I like this guy. He's goofy. That was like the first thing that I liked about the show. And then the second thing I liked about the show at that time, in that moment of time, it was like a breath of fresh air in the sense that you had the height of the Iraq War going on. And then you have the Young Turks, like, oh my God, it's like, here's an avenue, here's a venue that's like saying things and talking about things that the mainstream media at the time, and they still do to this day, that are not talking about it. And that was another reason why I liked the show. And also just overall, it was like funny and it was goofy. And then later on that year, I became a member on Christmas Day. And then there was a Robert Greenwald screening of Iraq for Sale months later on down the road. So I met Cenk and I met Jill Pike at the time. And then there was the race with Cenk and Jill.
Oh, yeah, the Cenk Jill race.
Yeah, it was the Cenk and Jill race. And I hung out there and I took some pictures of that. And then I got to know you, and then I got to know Edwin at the time, and then one thing led to another, and I just basically started hanging out and helping out with the show and doing editing clips at the time at the Wilshire Building. And then I was around the time with the whole MSNBC debacle.
Yeah, okay, but this is not about you. This is about TYC. So you've got
no. This is about stretching time, Dave. This is about stretching time.
No, no, I have some stuff to say. Okay. You don't need to stretch time anymore. Okay. Yeah, I want to acknowledge Bart's first contribution was to be our photographer at all these events. So people would show up, Bart would take the photos, and we'd grab Bart's photos and put those on our website to promote this stuff. So thank you. That was good stuff. That was long before you ever had a job here or anything. You were just a fan who believed in it and wanted to help out. I want to talk about that New York LA Times Sunday article. So back in those days, we were desperate and thirsty and justifiably so for publicity. And the thought was, all we have to do is get this ball rolling. We just need that first article. And then as soon as we're in the paper, that's legitimacy. And then other people can write about it and talk about it. And it'll blow, roll and roll like a snowball. Didn't quite work as fast as we wanted. But that LA Times Sunday article was a huge breakthrough for us. Even though it was front page of the, I think the arts and section, but maybe it was on the bottom of the main page. I don't remember.
No, it was on the front page of the calendar section.
Yeah, calendar section.
The LA Times.
LA Times.
Yeah.
And Cenk, knowing that that was going to come out, we knew a few days before that was going to come out. He planned to do we came in on that Sunday to do a live show. Because the thought was people are going to be reading their Sunday Times, like now no one does that. And they're going to say, oh, what's this? That's interesting. Young Turks, let me go to their website and see what's going on. And we wanted to give them a live show. It's a good idea. Like most things, it only worked a little. But that was Marathon Day. Marathon Day in LA, the city is impossible to travel through because they just cut roads. They cut the whole damn city in half. So it was very hard for some people to get to the office. I rode my bike, not a problem. And I love Marathon Day in LA because the streets are empty. You can bike around and stuff. But that was a fun day, a very important early day in TYT history. That, like Bart said, was 2005. The publicity snowball did not really get rolling at full speed, possibly yet. But it's rolling faster than it did back then, 12 years ago. 13 years ago. Oh, we should have a 13th anniversary party of that article.
Yeah.
And we used to have it in frames and everything.
I still have the actual article at home. I still have it. Actually, I should probably bring it in here and frame it. But you know what the best thing about that article is? You got me.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That was a big day in TYT. The other big day was when somehow Cenk made a fake publicity announcement that he was going to sue Stephen Colbert for stealing one of our jokes, and Yahoo picked it up and put it on their front page as news, and our web traffic that they blew sky high. It was awesome, and then it came back down, of course, but those are two big days. We're going to do some more nostalgia in a minute. We're going to wrap up this post-game show with more talk about things that TYD has done outside of the studio, which shows that we've always been believers in the movement, not just doing this show and having it stop there. But we want to translate this into real world action. So the other protest that I remember for now, and I may think of others, was outside the CNN building here in Los Angeles. I think it was during the time of the healthcare debate. And maybe a Democrat had proposed a public option alternative or something like that. And CNN wasn't giving it any coverage. So our protest was to go in front of the CNN building and chant, cover it, cover it, cover it. Give full coverage to all the alternatives, including the ones that are not favored by the big pharmaceutical industries that are advertisers to CNN and the big donors to the Democrats and Republicans. We wanted them to cover this proposal that was being, you know, considered on behalf of the people, and CNN, in its mainstream establishment point of view, was not covering it. So that protest in front of CNN gathered a lot more. It was a few years later, that, you know, 4 years after the enough protest, and we had more people in a crowded space. It was a very uncomfortable protest because we were walking around in a very tight sidewalk in front of the CNN building. I don't know if the people really got a sense of it. The enough protest in front of the federal building, that was at the location where all the many protests occur. That's a standard location right there on the corner of Wilshire and Veteran, I think, where there are many protests. A protest in front of the CNN building is kind of weird and unusual and rare. And this wasn't every week. It was a one-time thing. But it was a good turnout. Do you know about that? Did you attend that one?
No, I think like the first and the only last time I ever did a protest was the Enough protest. Because like I said before, it's like protesting, it's hard. It takes too much out of my time.
Yeah, and you were done with it.
I got better things to do. I got places to go and things to do. Yes, I do.
So then while we're on this, the one I think, of course, everyone knows, but now we've been doing this many years, there's a lot of new members, not everyone knows it, was the famous day when Cenk delivered his message to Occupy Wall Street when he launched and announced the launch of Wolfpack. There's a great video on it. Go to YouTube to find it, where it's raining and Cenk's outside it in Zuccotti Park, where Occupy Wall Street was centered, and he's giving the speech to the crowd at Occupy Wall Street with the, you know, call and response type of, you know, their communication system where everything was repeated. And it's a great video which launched Wolfpack. That's part of TYT imagery and lore now. So that's a third one that we did. We did a really fun protest that I attended in Washington outside the Treasury Department during the Obama years. I think the point of that one was to encourage Tim Geithner to prosecute Goldman Sachs for some financial misdeed. We got a pretty good turnout for that one too. Unfortunately, it was raining or lightly raining for that one also, which was a real pain. I don't know what if anything, we chanted on that one, but Cenk gave a speech. It was a good turnout. It's Washington. People are into politics there. So if it hadn't been for the rain, that one would have been big. That was a lot of fun. Cenk did another protest in Washington a few years after that I did not attend. That was in front of a lobbyist's office, and I forget what the point of that protest was. But in general, it was against money and getting money out of politics. He led a little march to a lobbyist's office. And that's something that probably no one's ever done before. Protests are usually in front of well-recognized, you know, landmarks. But the problem, one of the big problems with our government is the lobbyist firms who have taken over the government, and no one's out there in front of them protesting them until Cenk decided to do it. And this was just a few years ago. So that was great, even though I didn't attend that one. Bart, do you remember any other outside of studio things that we did that are memorable?
Let's see. The only ones that I can remember are the Cenk and Anna, the Cenk and Anna race.
I remember
that one.
And of course, it's not a protest, but those were a lot of fun.
Yeah, you know, it's like for me, it's like, you know, like I said, I don't protest that much because it's like I got other things to do, and I'd rather be entertained. That's why I was kind of entertained on the Enough protest. But it's like the functions that I like are a little bit on the light side, I guess you can say, because the weight of the world for me is heavy as it is. So I think, like, for me, another favorite one function that I liked was the race between Cenk.
Sure. So going back to our earlier conversation, right now, I think it's inconceivable that Cenk would take on some female at TYT and do a public race against her.
That's
not professional. That's not. So we did have that identity, that authenticity. We were real people back then doing these things. I don't think that would happen now, and that's sad. But on the other hand, I'm glad we did it. We did it twice, once with Jill, once with Anna. So for those TYT fans and members who were there in the day, you got to enjoy a great ride. Now, it's going to be even greater now in the future, but it's going to be more serious, and it's going to be more based on what we do rather than these peripheral activities outside of the studio, you know. But go to YouTube and check out, I think there's video for both of those. Terrible quality, low res video. Cenk's race with Jill and Cenk's race with Anna.
Oh, just like I just remembered of my favorite, well, no, not my favorite, but an unfortunate moment during the race between Cenk and Jill. There was like a little mini race between Michael Schur and JR.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Right.
And they did a mini race, and after that race, JR wasn't feeling very good.
Yeah.
You know, Mr. Track and Field guy.
Right.
He wasn't feeling good. We had to call the paramedics, right. And it was scary and it was terrible. And I just remember him like laying on the ground, like pointing up and his finger, and it was scary. Yeah. I remember that.
I kind of got there late for that. But the lesson there is don't race. Like if you want to do exercise, take it easy. Don't race at your full speed. That's crazy. If you're above the age of 21.
Well, not only that, like exercise and racing, it's overrated. Just come on, it's overrated, guys.
But that's true. That all the great runners, the Jills and the Annas and the JRs, collapsed, and Jenk prevailed against all of them. I mean, I don't know what happened in the race between JR and Michael. If anyone won, or they didn't really finish, I don't know.
I think. I can't remember. I think JR won that race.
Yeah, right. But it cost him. It cost him.
Yeah, it cost. Yeah, for the moment, it was a scary moment.
Yeah, and just in case it's not clear to everyone, Jenk beat both Jill and Anna. But I don't think either one of them finished.
No, it was like he
just outlasted.
Yeah, he was outran him.
It's a metaphor for his career and for TYT. And yes, and we're gonna outlast, and we're gonna be here, and we're gonna be covering these stories, and we're gonna have authenticity mixed with professionalism, and it's gonna be great. The post game show isn't in any danger of dying or going away. In fact, I hope you've enjoyed how long it's been. It's gotten longer. This would have ended half an hour ago under normal circumstances. But so you got a little bit of news stories at the beginning and a little bit of nostalgia toward the end. And play me some music. Music is nice. It's not real music, right? It's just rights, free music.
From that generic music. I wish we could play music, but...
Yeah, I wish you could play some Bolivian Andean.
Thank you, Dave, music. For letting me be on with you.
Thank you, Bart.